I do appreciate you taking some time out with me today. That's awesome.
Oh, no problem. Sorry, I was a little delayed. I had a basketball awards ceremony for my son's team last night.
Nice. And,
come to find out that it was for every sport and every team, not just they had to recognize three different levels of sports in three different sports. So
nice.
I'm glad to be here and excited to talk.
Yeah, man. Awesome. That's great. Yeah, I know. And I got five kids myself. So it's like a Royal Rumble all the time at my house.
That's awesome. We have a campus pastor here in town. He's a really good friend of mine who moved up here to help us with the church. And they just had their fifth daughter. So they have five girls.
Five girls.
Yeah.
Got to add that guy to our prayer list over here.
I'm telling you, I was like, man, if you need to have a one-on-one meeting with me so that I can explain to you the process of how this works, just let me know. I'm sure you guys could have your own podcast together and might not be able to have your own podcast because there'd be so many kids running around that you wouldn't be able to finish the recording.
I think that'd be the unique part. We'll both have our kids just running around in the background throwing their comments in.
Basketball teams, each of you have enough to put five people on the court.
Absolutely.
That's so cool.
Yeah, man. I love it. Love it. Yeah. So it's funny. We never met in person. I do follow you online though. I watch all the great things that you're doing. So we're going to become best friends right now.
Love
and
that.
Introduce you to our audience and get some, we got to get the important questions out of the way. So first thing is favorite food.
Yeah. I think I go in phases and seasons. I think currently I'd probably be a Chipotle guy. So like Tex-Mex.
Okay.
But it goes in phases. Sometimes I'm like a Chinese food guy and I'll go to, you know.
Well, you're in Raleigh, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So how's the Chinese food over there?
There's one little spot downtown called Five Star. It's very good, actually.
Yeah.
It's not like carry out or takeout. It's like a high-end Chinese food place, but it's gotcha. Pretty good. And then ultimately, like I am a carnivore. I love to hunt wild game, big game, and then I love to consume that same game that we caught. So a lot of steak in the house, a lot of red meat in the house, so spaghetti, tacos.
Well, that was gonna be my next question. When you order a steak, how do you order it?
Yeah, anything less than medium, you know, is fine with me. Meat, no more than medium, you know. I had a friend who had a well done steak, and I left him at the restaurant because he's still chewing.
Did it offend you personally, like to your core, to your heart?
I mean, we couldn't even talk about it because he was chewing the whole time.
Very cool. Too funny, man. Too funny. Have you ever been to New York before?
I have been to New York. Just the tourist side, maybe a little outside of that. But we ate at this place actually in New York, in Manhattan, called Gallagher's. Yeah. It's a steakhouse, Gallagher's Steakhouse.
Yeah.
We really liked that place. That place was really, really good. That was a special occasion. That was our 15-year wedding anniversary. I wouldn't go to Gallagher's like every night of the week type thing, but that was a special occasion. That was really good. Really loved New York. We stayed on Billionaire's Row
and
there by Central Park, and had a really good time. We did all the touristy things. So, you know, the touristy stuff.
So Long Island is a little different than the city aspect of it, because Long Island, you have like the majority, it's so vast. Like you could be driving, let's just say an hour, you're going to hit farm, you're going to hit mountains, and then you're 20 minutes away from city. You go north, you're at the beach, south, you're at the beach within 15, 20 minutes. So you kind of got the best of all the worlds all mixed up in one.
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't get to anywhere like that. We were just strictly doing Christmas and New Year's, New York City stuff, all the stuff that we left New Year's Eve, actually. So we got out before it got crazy.
Smart man.
We stayed Christmas through New Year's Eve, and we just did all your standard typical, like,
right,
what you guys make fun of people for doing. we did all that, you know.
Listen, you gotta do it at least Broadway.
Yeah, we saw some Broadway shows, we saw the Rockefeller Center tree, you know, ice skating, the whole, all the things that you see in the movies, Macy's. You know, we did all that. It was a good time. We had a really, really great time.
I hope you enjoyed yourself in the Big Apple over there.
Yeah, we liked it.
Great, man. Awesome. So I guess I want to start off with our jumping point here about a little bit about your history, your past. Were you always raised a Christian? So a lot of our audience is I would say 50-50 Christian, non-Christian. And then where we get pumped out into different secular locations, it's mostly non-Christian. So I always like our guests to introduce, because a lot of my guests too are not Christian as well. And we get their perspectives on God and faith and different obstacles they have in believing and different things like that. And it's really curious to see where people are coming from. So tell me a little about, did you grow up Christian, the Christian home, Christian family?
Yeah, I was a Christian 9 months before I was born. So I've been a Christian for a really long time. Right. I don't know any other life. I mean, I would do cannonballs in the baptismal tank, you know, on baptism Sunday when they had the big pool filled up with water. I just start swimming in it. You know, that was just, I just thought that was normal. Right. I'm so Christian, you know, on communion Sundays, I would just eat the leftover bread of Jesus. And so I was full of Jesus. Thank God it was just juice and not real wine where we were from, because if it would have been real wine, I would have been an intoxicated 8-year-old. So I grew up real Christian. I'm third generation full-time minister. And so,
oh wow,
what it means to be full, you know, third generation full-time minister means that, like, my grandfather is still in full-time ministry. He spent 50 years in Africa. My parents are in full-time ministry. They spent 30 years in Spain as missionaries. Now wow. They pastor a church right down the road here with us. And so I've been doing this. We started this church 10 years ago, but before that I was in youth ministry for 5 years before that. So I've been doing this for 15 years as well. So we're all three still full-time ministry. And so some might say it's the family business, but the way that we look at it is, although I grew up in church and I grew up around church, there's a point where I had to make the decision for myself. I don't have to follow Jesus by myself, but I did have to make the decision for myself. And, you know, you can't, you know, there are no grandchildren of God. We're all either sons of God or we're not. And so I had to decide that I was not going to hang on to my parents' coattails long term, or just ride the wave of my grandfather's legacy or my father's legacy. But I had a real encounter with Jesus when I was 8 years old. And then another real encounter with Jesus again when I was 12 years old, where he called me into the ministry full time. And so as much as I've been around it my whole life, and as much as I grew up around it, there is an evidence that the Lord spoke to me specifically. And so I think that that's important to realize, is that I don't just get into this because that's what my dad did and it's what my grandpa did, but I really do feel called and passionate. And I never felt under any obligation from my grandparents. Like, I was never under obligation from my parents. They weren't like, you better be a pastor, you know, you better be a preacher. If not, you know, who's going to carry it on? It was a calling. We use the word calling in our circle. It was a real clear evidence that God was stirring something in my heart, even at a young age. And so I ran from the call a little bit. I didn't get super rebellious like some people do, but I did, you know, I deviated and thought I was going to be a rock star. I played in a band called the Eighth Hour Romance. I was the bass player.
Okay.
And I thought, man, I'm going to be a rock star. I'm going to fill arenas and play the bass guitar professionally. And once all of us in the band started having kids and we had to bring strollers into the, you know, venues that we were playing, it just ended up not working out as well as we thought.
Gotcha. So, yeah, that was going to be my question, was about the pressure of being not only just a pastor's kid, a PK, but also grandfather as well, too, in full-time ministry. What were some of the, when you had that experience with God at 12, did you know that you, like, without a shadow of a doubt, that you were going to be called into some type of ministry? Or were you fighting it? Were you running? Were you wrestling? Were you struggling with that? Because not even just in, I feel, church, a lot of us have a struggle kind of finding our place where we fit in, where we believe we're going to flourish in any aspect of our life, especially at that young age.
Yeah, I didn't know what it would look like. You know, I never saw, like, this church plant that I now lead that, you know, God has really blessed us over the past 10 years. I didn't see any of that. I think obedience is one of those things that once you feel called by God in your heart, then you just have to be obedient to him with small steps. And right. So, like, I think about, there's a biblical account of the shepherd boy David. And he's a young shepherd boy, and he gets called out in front of all of his brothers. If you don't know the story, this prophet comes to town. All of his brothers are there, and they pour oil on the one who's going to be king. They pour oil on his head as a sign of like marking them for the next king. Well, the story goes, David, he doesn't even get invited to the party. You know, he gets bypassed by all of his brothers. But the prophet that came to town says, none of these are it. These are not going to be the king. Where's the one? It was like his dad didn't even invite him. He's like, well, I got one more guy, but he's out in the field, you know. And sure enough, David gets oil poured on his head. He's the king. But he had to go back to the fields to be a shepherd. And so the way I see calling and the way that I see identity in Jesus is like sometimes you'll have this dream or desire of oil running down your beard, but you have to go back to the same job that, you know, you don't really like, or the same cubicle where your boss is a jerk, but you got royalty rolling down your head and it's on your beard. It's like, you know that you're destined for more, but there are seasons of extreme obedience where what's on your head can't go to your head because it doesn't yet line up with what God's timing is. And so I think that that's probably what I went through at 12 or 14 is just like knowing that there was a call, but I had to finish high school.
Right, you know? Right.
Knowing that there's a call, I still gotta have birthday parties. And you know, I can't just go lock myself up in a prayer closet at 12 years old and wait for the glory to come and I'll go into my public ministry, you know. Even Jesus was a carpenter. Like even Jesus wasn't born in a manger and then start doing miracles immediately. It took, you know, 30 years of probably carpentry, education, normal kids stuff. And then he was able to, you know, to finally realize the miracle working power and come public with his ministry.
No, it's great points. Really, really awesome points. What about relatability issues with people your age growing up and even now reaching all different types of people? I don't know what the demographic is of your local town or your impact. I know you got multiple campuses and different locations and stuff. What is, I guess the two-part question is, you know, growing up, relating to some of the kids that were in the world and being able to be that light there, and then wrapping that around the demographic of where you grew up. Is it mostly Christian towns? And then dealing with backslidden Christians, or is it just...
Yeah, well, my parents are missionaries in Europe, so it was crazy town. I mean, this is way past Christianity in a post-Christian society. Nobody was a Christian. I mean, we were happy if somebody like knew who Jesus was on the campus. So probably a little bit like some of the parts of the Northeast or some of the parts of our country where it's so steeped in tradition that it's no longer relational. It's just religion, and it's kind of forgotten, and it's so traditional that, you know, a lot of Catholics in Spain. So where I grew up is heavily Catholic. It's heavily traditional, very non-committal, non-relational with the Lord. They wouldn't know what salvation through faith alone, by grace. They wouldn't know anything like that. They would just know that that's where they go on Christmas and Easter.
Right.
So my family probably did stick out a lot. My parents were extremely conservative. I mean, I wasn't allowed to do anything. I mean, I couldn't do anything. When I say I couldn't do anything, I wasn't allowed to do anything. I think the only show we could watch was Andy Griffith, which if you don't know what Andy Griffith is, it's like a black and white television show in the early days. We could only watch Andy Griffith. Maybe if she watched the Murder, She Wrote episode and it was clean, then we could watch an episode of Murder, She Wrote.
Okay.
But my mom, I mean, it was so bad. My mom had a blanket over the TV. She would put it over the television during the commercials. So
really?
I mean, that's kind of the level of conservatism that we grew up in.
Wow.
Holiness was a big deal. My grandparents on my mom's side, not the missionaries, but the ones that were stateside from Alabama, grew up in very holiness movement, which basically means, for those who are listening that might not know, it's just like this real, almost like this real religious view of righteousness and holiness, where my grandfather, he would mow the grass with a tie on, with slacks and a white shirt. You know, he was, you never were seen not dressed up. You know, he would go to Waffle House and dress up, you know.
Right.
So that kind of conservative mindset and ideology, you know, carried over a little bit. So we looked weird in Europe. Obviously we were missionaries, so we had the whole reputation to keep and everything like that. I'd say one of the things that was really tough was like just not being able to go to the places where the other kids, it was normal for them. You know, they would talk about things that I had no experience with, you know, locker room talk as a kid or as a middle schooler or a high schooler. I mean, I was very unfamiliar with a lot of the terms that most kids would know. So yeah, I think that definitely was weird. My upbringing was definitely strange. And one of those things where I don't think I regret one minute of it. I think I look back and I'm grateful for the grace and the covering, or the trying to use words that maybe if you didn't know what those words meant, like the protection that my parents provided me was, was excellent. And it could have seemed weird at the time, but looking at the world now, you know, 20 years later, they were right. You know,
right.
I think that's key. I hope that
how much have you adopted of that into your own now, you know, relationship, parenthood, everything?
Yeah. I mean, we bought some land. We churn our own butter. We're pretty conservative. You know, I wouldn't say we're as hyper conservative. We have a television. I don't have a blanket to put over the TV, but you know, my kids have cell phones, but they're monitored.
Sure.
I think it carried over. I mean, my girls are homeschooled. My son goes to an all boys school, private Christian all boys academy. Right. So I would say that those conservative values are still trying to be maintained.
Right.
The world is harder and harder. It gets more challenging. I mean, unless you're going to live completely off the grid, it's just going to be almost impossible to miss, you know, some of the things that the world promotes. But we do a pretty good job at being the first. I think we don't let the world teach our kids first. I think that's really the key. It's like, yeah, in order to raise, for what we're trying to raise, which is conservative Christians, and I'm not talking political conservatism. I'm talking like Christian conservative Christian, a manner of righteous living, sanctification, and holiness. And I know if you're not a believer, those words won't matter. But according to biblical standard is probably a good way to put it. Like if we're trying to raise kids according to a biblical standard, then I have to teach them first. I can't let the cultural standard teach them first.
Absolutely. So
raising kids in 2023 means biblical standard first. And if the world gets to them, they'll have already formulated in their mind their biblical worldview that came from their parents, their family of origin.
Sure.
And that's hard. It's hard work. Yeah. And it's not fun. There's awkward conversations at younger ages than you thought were necessary. But it just seems to be the way that we tend to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Just with everything going on, with everything so in your face. I agree. I'm having conversations with my, you know, third, fourth and fifth graders. Kids just like, you know, it's like, my goodness, man, we got to be talking about this right now at this age. Some of the words that they're using and saying, what their friends are saying, it's a whole different world than when I was younger. That's for sure.
1000%. It's a totally different world. And I don't see it improving until, well, we believe the rapture is going to happen. So I don't see it improving until the end of time, which is when Jesus comes back to, rapture all of those who believe.
So I guess on that, let's talk about Focus Church. When was that moment where you and your wife got together and you're like, man, the Lord is having us plant a church? I read a little bit where you guys started in a living room, right? Was it a living room with a handful of people? We have similar stories there. I started my mother-in-law's house with the same about 6, 7, 8 people, casting vision and laying down foundation. So share a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we had our third kid. And when we had our third child, we were in youth ministry and we just found ourselves tired all the time. You know, it's like, man, we can't keep ordering pizza and playing video games and doing lock-ins and all-night events and camp and stuff. We were just tired. We had three kids, you know, we were becoming, we're like the progressive commercial where it talks about becoming your parents. It's like we were becoming old people. And we weren't old by any stretch, but we just felt really compelled to reach more families and not just students. And so I don't know if there was like a definitive audible voice moment, but it was after we had our third child that it was became clear that we were ready to reach families. And because we were ready to reach families, we needed to figure out what that looked like. And I never wanted to start a church out of rebellion
Right.
I never wanted to start a church as the angry youth pastor and just go right down the road and take a couple of families. And, you know, anything that's birthed out of rebellion just never seems to be blessed. And so we decided that we would end well at the church that we were youth pastors at, and that we would pack everything that we owned and we would move, you know, 600, 700 miles away to North Carolina, to a place that we had never met a single soul. We had never been before. We only visited one time. We found one lady who wouldn't do a credit check in order to rent us our townhome. And so we had really, you know, we had no money. And so we needed someone that would really trust us. And we got into that townhome and we started gathering in our living room. About seven people showed up the first Sunday. And, you know, 10 years later, we're one church in three locations, seeing over 1,000 people worship with us every single weekend. And we've baptized hundreds of people over the past 10 years. And to God be the glory, we're just getting started. We have a big, big plans in store.
I love it, man. I love it. I love when definitely checking you out and checking out the church and reading up on your website, man. It looks like you got something really moving over there in Raleigh.
Yeah, you know, I never thought it would be like this. We came here ready to pastor a community, like one town. And in my heart, I still am the same guy. Super normal, you know, it's not flashy. I don't have an entourage. You know, when we moved here, I just thought, I'm going to pastor this town for the rest of my life. I'm going to give my life to these people. The town was called Apex, which is where we have one of our locations. And I remember just thinking, this is going to be, I'm going to just pastor this town. I'm going to walk the streets of this town and everyone's going to see me as the local chaplain or the pastor in town. And as God began to grow our hearts, it's like having children. I don't love Apex less than I did when I first started. I just so happen to now love Raleigh, Knightdale, Garner, Durham, Wake Forest more. And so I think the Lord just grew my heart. You know, when you have a second child, you don't love the first child less. Your heart just grows. And over the past 10 years, my heart has grown to really embrace and love the entire city and what God is doing here. And it's really special. God has given us a really special grace during this time.
I love it. What's the mission of, like, what do you see God doing in and through your ministry? What are some of the goals that you guys have laid out in regards to, again, spreading the gospel, kingdom living, all that type of stuff?
Yeah. So there's a couple of distinctives that we kind of love to talk about around our church when it comes to vision. Number one, we ask God for a tenth of the city, so a tithe of the population. So we'd love to reach 10% of Raleigh one day. Now, we're far from that, and we still have a lot of work to do, but that's kind of our big goal. Like, if God would give us one out of every 10 people in Raleigh, we would feel like his mission would be complete. The great thing about that mission is, as population grows, you can never really get there, but you can always try.
Sure.
And I think that's kind of our desire and our dream, is to see a tenth of the city be reached here in Raleigh. The second distinctive that we talk about a lot is our church's overwhelming diversity when it comes to race and age. It's one of the unique graces that God has put on our life. And when I say grace, one of the unique things about our church is we tend to reach people that don't all look the same. So if you come in on a Sunday, you will find that our South location is about 80% African-American and about 10% Hispanic and 10% Caucasian. If you come to our East location, you'll find about 60% African-American and about 30% Caucasian and 10% Hispanic. Then if you go to our West location, you'll find about 80% Caucasian and then, 10% African-American, 10% Hispanic and other, you know. But what you'll find is that there's not a real ethnic majority at Focus Church. So if you go into Focus, you'll be like confused. You'll think, am I at a black church? Because if you've never been to a black church, it feels like a black church.
Right.
But if you're white, it feels like a black church, essentially. But if you're black and you walk in, it feels like a white church. You'll like, am I at a white church? And then if you're Hispanic, they identify with me because my last name is Santiago and I'm from Puerto Rican descent, you know. So then they're like, well, I might, maybe this, the pastor's Hispanic, the pastor's wife is white, but the church is Black. And so it's a real unique grace that we have that really allows us to reach all kinds of people. And what we've seen is just this amazing window of people, kingdom-minded people that are okay worshiping next to people who don't look like them. And then you get granular with what their lives are like, and they probably didn't vote like you or don't really come from the same background as you do. But in the end, if Jesus, if they've acknowledged Jesus as their Lord and Savior, we will be in heaven together. Yeah. And so we might as well get used to it now. And that's kind of what Focus Church is all about, is we want to see a tenth of the tithe of the city's population. And we never want to lose our distinctive, which is our racial diversity. If there was one more that we talk about a lot of times, it's how to do multi-site, so multiple locations with me on the video, and still remain Pentecostal or charismatic or spirit-led, which just basically means we're from a Pentecostal theological background. If you're listening to this and maybe those terms are unaware, or you're not aware of those terms, basically it's a fancy way of saying we believe in the whole Bible and in the same miracles, signs, and wonders that took place in the Bible. We believe that every believer that believes in Jesus still has access to those spiritual gifts even to this day. So that's what it means to be, for us to be Pentecostal or charismatic or spirit-led or spirit-filled. A bunch of different words for the same kind of thing, which means we just believe in the outpouring of God's Spirit is still in operation today.
Right. I love that. And I love even the focus on diversity. And I think sometimes people don't understand how difficult that could be, just because we naturally kind of move to people that look like us, talk like us, think like us, have similar backgrounds to us. But truth be told, this is what heaven's going to look like, right? Heaven's going to look like people from all different backgrounds, colors, languages, different expressions of worship, right? Some people worship certain ways. They like the different it's really amazing. So it is effort to gather all under that one name of Jesus. But I really do believe when you do that, it's just so powerful to see God manifesting in that. And I'm sure you've seen similar things where, you know, you have people that don't even speak the same language and they're praying over each other and the tears are leaping. They're having this experience with God. And you know, this is real because they don't even understand what this person's saying in English.
Correct.
But they're just touching, they're just having a moment with the Holy Spirit. Allowing God to just really start doing a work in their life. And that's when you know God's really starting to do something.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then peeling over to really the focus of what I wanted to have you on today, Pastor Mike, is what we've recently been experiencing in Asbury. And it's something that my heart yearns for, even though, you know, you hear these word revivals thrown around all the time. You know, people have different kind of, I guess, images of what revival is in their brain and what it looks like. And to break it down to its core function of confession and repentance, and then watching God move and manifest in and through that. I just feel like we're ripe for a real big move of God to take place. And we think that, you know, we need a Christian president and Christian politicians and Christian businessmen and Christian this and Christian that to see God move or have God's will be done. But really, if you just look throughout history, truth be told, it's the exact opposite. And right. I believe those situations create a yearning and a desire for Christians to do what they probably should be doing the whole time.
Right.
Broken prayer, worshiping, seeking, and it kind of forces us to be who we say we are. So I guess let's start with, how did you hear about this? What were your first impressions of it? And what motivated you to go over there and check out what was happening?
Yeah. So, you know, I think we're so blessed in the West. So, and the Western Church, that I think if we had an ounce of persecution, we would understand that we've been living in revival for a long time. So,
right.
Revival isn't just a tent that comes to town, or the, you know, when I was growing up, whenever you saw the motorhome outside of a church, that was the evangelist that was in town for that week at that church, you know? So if you saw an RV parked on the church parking lot, you were like, oh, they must be having revival, you know? So I grew up in this. This is what I grew up, you know, annual revivals, or, you know, 3 days ablaze, you know, 3 day revivals. I've been a student and now a teacher of, you know, I would say not manipulation, but manufactured move of gods or structured. Let's call them structured move of gods. And I would just say that here in America, we're so free. We are so free to worship. Even now, even though it seems bad, we're still so free to worship that what we deem as revival, take it or leave it. You know, I think what Asbury was, although the word revival is probably the easiest way to describe it, there was a huge spirit of renewal, which means it wasn't that God was dead at Asbury or God was dead in America. God's been very much alive. I mean, we planted a church, went from 7 people to 1,000 people in 10 years. And some might not call that revival, but if you're from my seat, you would say we've worked as though we've been meeting every single day as if it was revival, because that's from 7 to 1,000 is revival in our minds. So there was a huge spirit of renewal. And I want to be very clear. When I went to Asbury, I took my 15-year-old daughter on purpose because it was a college student. It is a college student outpouring. It's an extended chapel service. So we need to kind of like, I think, get all the way down to like what took place that started it. And it was a sermon where the guy who preached the sermon felt like he didn't do a good job. There's even text messages to his wife. Like this was another blunder or another, you know, mediocre sermon. He has like text message he sent to his friend, a big whiff, like he whiffed the sermon, like he didn't do a good job. Little did he know that this would become that, right? So goes to show you, revival can't be planned. It's definitely not based on the backs of some personality. And I would say that what happened there was a spirit of renewal. So the Bible says to renew a right spirit within me, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. So it wasn't that something was dead and it was revived. I think something was being cleaned and being renewed. It would be like a restoration. If you took an old car and you renewed that car by cleaning it, polishing it, hammering out all the dents, restoring something. I didn't feel like it was revival. I felt like it was renewal. And so a couple of things we have to remember. It was for college students. So God chose to pour out his spirit on college students, which is massive. Because I think if we all were to audit where a lot of the deviation from our values is going, it's in college age kids. I think we can raise them up in church, in kids ministry and youth ministry, but when they have to decide for themselves, you know, am I going to follow God or not? College tends to be the break. So for God to choose college to be the renewal agent is huge, huge. And I think it's so important. I think the school and the kids at the school had pure motives the whole time. I do not think there was a single ounce, and they protected it. They protected this spirit with immense protection. There was no one over the age of 25 in charge at all. It was all college led. There wasn't some guy in sitting on his big chair on the stage waiting to be called up to preach. As a matter of fact, for the 5 hours that I was there, there was no preaching. There was a couple of verses that were read. There was one moderator who looked like a college age person. I don't know how old she actually was, but she just kind of gave certain announcements and what was available and what was going to happen the next couple of days. But other than that, pure, uncompromising, unadulterated worship, acoustic guitar, box drum, piano, but all at a very low decibel level. So you could not hear the instruments or the singers that were singing into the microphone very good.
Wow.
The main thing was the congregation, and the place was packed. I mean, it was standing room only. They tried to keep it to college students up front and close. They really tried their best. By the time I got there, it had gotten almost out of hand. It was like, I got there the day that Tucker Carlson ran his segment on it.
Okay. And
so when it was on Fox News is when it got, like, I say out of hand, just a lot of people, you know, they couldn't fit anymore.